I'm Gabe Filippelli, and this is Season 5 of The Collective Tap, podcasting from the College of Communication at Butler University. This season, we're diving into 5 important issues facing water and our communities in Indiana. In this episode, we're talking about a class of contaminant that is gaining more attention and for very good reason. The chemical compounds PFAS, P-F-A-S, and PFOA, P-F-O-A, as they're typically referred to, were even the subject of a 2019 movie called Dark Water. At the heart of all these stories, though, these disaster stories, something much more ugly and something often intertwined in a mix of science and emerging science, profit, people make money off of things and products, and disinformation. Today, we're going to talk about what these chemicals are, where they come from, the risks they pose, and what the government is doing to address what is considered a rapidly emerging crisis. So let's get our hazmat suits on and wade into the world of alphabet soups and forever chemicals. I'm joined today by Dr. Marta Vanier, an environmental chemist at the Paul H. O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University Bloomington, or as we used to call it in the old days, SPIA, and State Representative Maureen Bauer, who represents House District 6 in northeastern Indiana, northern Indiana. Welcome, both of you, to the Collective Tap.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Gabe.
Hi. Maureen, I want to start with you as a, not as a layperson, but as someone who represents kind of the decision-making body who are ostensibly there to help protect Hoosiers from things that might hurt them. How did these chemicals come onto your radar, either as an individual or as a representative? And what were your initial thoughts and concerns when you heard about them?
Right. So I'm serving my second term as a state legislator, and my district is in South Bend. And back in 2019, 2 firefighters in South Bend died of a very rare form of brain cancer at relatively young ages, in their 40s and 50s. And we were trying to understand why. It turns out that cancer is the leading cause of line of duty deaths among the fire service. And for a very long time, firefighters were told that their gear was safe, that it was protecting them. But because of a lot of the research that Dr. Graham Peasley did right in our backyard in Notre Dame, we learned differently, that their gear and the AFFF firefighting foam that's been used to fight some of the most dangerous fires, these industrial fires or used in airports, actually has the ability to either leach into their bloodstream and cause some very severe health concerns, among them cancers. My first term began in 2020, first introduced legislation in 2021, and we tried to look into the link between the PFAS in their gear and in their foam and these cancer diagnoses. And so that was kind of the driving force between my interest in looking into legislation around PFAS.
Okay, so they're a bit of a canary in the coal mine in this case, a first indicator that that there are some concerns with this chemical because they're exposed to it at probably higher amounts than other.
Yeah, their profession, they're exposed both through their gear, through the foam. You know, for a long time, firefighters were told their, you know, dirtiest helmet was a point of pride, but now they are enacting these new standard operating procedures. They decontaminate before they go back to the firehouse. Even dust that's found in the firehouse has high levels of PFAS. They're learning more to keep themselves safe, but it's also a responsibility of us as policymakers to keep them safe, to allow them to know more about their own health. When there's new advancements in technology, to allow them to invest in it. And so that's the ideas that I tried to come up with through legislation have been geared around.
And I know that we're concerned about, even the general populace is beginning to be concerned about these chemicals. Now, Marta, you specialize in alphabets, clearly, in all things forever. You know, these things are called forever chemicals for, I think, a pretty good reason. Could you give us first like an OCHEM 101 definition of what these chemicals are, what they're used for, and how they're applied generally?
Yes, we are into an alphabet soup. Sometimes I joke that we should buy vowels in there to make it simpler. PFAS are very fascinating molecules. And the reason why they're called forever chemicals is because the bond between carbon and fluorine, which characterizes this molecule, is one of the strongest one in nature, and it cannot be broken down by sunlight or by weather in general, like other molecules. And so once they are into the environment and in our bodies, they stay there forever, for very long times. Because of these properties, as you can imagine, they are really useful. They have been used in a lot of applications. Whenever they're added to consumer products, they impart very desirable properties. So they make products non-stick. So think about pans that we use to fry our eggs. They also make products waterproof. So all our weather gear, tents, camping gear is treated with PFAS. Also, they prevent stains from sticking. So there's clothing. There's also, we detected PFAS in children's school uniforms, of all things, but also carpets and all of the spray, I won't say the brand, all the spray that we used to, we use in our homes on carpets and sofas to prevent stains from stick. Those are PFAS. Because of their unique properties, they've been used for decades, I want to say at this point, in large amounts in a variety of applications, including also more personal products like cosmetics, for example. Waterproof and longwear cosmetics also contain PFAS. Dental floss contain PFAS, ski wax. There's so many uses of PFAS that just narrowing down has been a challenge. Once they are added to these products, they are not necessarily that strongly bonded to the product. So as we use the products, they can get released from those products and get into the dust, as Maureen mentioned, into the air, and more importantly, into the water. These are the most common routes of exposure for people, for the general population, unless you live in an area that has been known to be contaminated with what Maureen mentioned as AFFF. So the firefighting foams that has been used in commercial airports, but also military bases. And so the massive use of those foams have contaminated underground water, and that's how some locations have higher levels of PFAS.
And so you heard it here first. This Professor Vanier says, no dental floss. Stop flossing. Your dentist is completely wrong about that. But you also said something else, which is probably more apt, about it in people's bodies. If you were to carefully analyze some body part of me, skin, blood, hair, urine, I don't know, would you find PFAS in me?
Yes. Wow. 99.9% of the U.S. population have PFAS in them.
Wow.
Because we've all been exposed. I didn't test my own blood, but I'm fairly certain that we would all have PFAS levels.
So 100 years ago, I assume, they didn't use or hadn't developed PFAS yet?
Correct.
So
they were
wow.
developed in the 70s.
70s, okay. So this is a little bit of an adventure in chemistry, right? A natural experiment which might have unnatural impacts. And Maureen, tell me a little bit about, because you introduced the situation. In this case, they were firefighters who have terrible forms of cancer, which apparently are quite rare. What is the state of regulations locally here in Indiana and at the national level? And did anything in particular happen in the last section of the state legislature? And what might be coming next?
So the very first piece of legislation started before I got elected, which was in 2020. The governor enacted a piece of legislation to ban AFFF, firefighting foam, in training exercises. He recognized that it was a contaminant at airports and military bases. It was being found in groundwater and drinking water, and it was, again, likely to be harming our first responders are firefighters. So it was only to be used in those severe circumstances, fuel fires or large industrial fires.
So can I get quick clarification? Because this is an interesting point. They develop this and use it because it stops fires faster, right? Fuel fires?
Right. Very intense fires.
Okay. Thank you.
So it's not necessarily used in everyday household fires. There's alternatives, safer alternatives. And so this was priority of the governor, Holcomb administration, and the Indiana Department of Homeland Security, led by them. And since then, they've collected and destroyed nearly 36,600 gallons of foam. That was earlier in this year. So it's something they've been really proud of. Departments have voluntarily given up their foam. They're happy to destroy it. Many of them don't use it anymore because they know it's very dangerous and outdated. So that happened before I got there. My piece of legislation I introduced was to do blood testing. As you mentioned, we all have this in our blood. And so I wanted to measure in firefighters the levels of contamination to truly see if they are exposed higher than other industries. And since the pandemic, there has been a at-home blood testing kit that was developed by a company called Eurofins that now the state of Indiana has partnered with, which now has become law, which passed in 2023 and has now gone into effect. And firefighters are now able to enroll in the testing program. They are able to be eligible for the blood testing, which would be done at home. They will do a finger prick blood test, and their results will be sent back to them at home, and then they'll be interpreted with their doctor, and they can determine either to get more cancer screenings, to prioritize maybe more checkups, to either monitor their cholesterol levels, or maybe prioritize a yearly health screening, maybe more than 4 or 5 times a year, to hopefully give them tools about their own health that they've been missing. I also want to go back. That same year, we prioritized a piece of legislation. Since there is not accessible PFAS-free gear on the market, I think there is now new gear that's PFAS-free. It's just not quite cheap enough or accessible enough to fully replace multiple departments' gear. In the state of Indiana, we have a label added inside the gear saying this contains PFAS. Okay. So you're no longer being misled that your gear is PFAS-free.
I just want to mention that it's really important that firefighters are able to get these tests for free, because we should say that these analyses are pretty expensive. So they would not be able to afford them unless they were provided by the state of Indiana. Right. So I think it's a great initiative, and I'm glad that they have access to this.
Yeah, we're quoted, I think the state's getting them for about $350, but if you went to your doctor, it was about $600 just to get that test done.
Wow, and you wonder if it would be covered by any insurance.
Right.
You know, who knows?
Right.
So what you described is very much what I saw the state of play. This is still currently true for firearm use and lead exposure for people who have to train on gun ranges, for example. Even the best ranges, people who are doing training exercises, you know, like the first responders, they all have elevated blood lead levels after training exercise. And so there's certain controls in place to monitor that and to work with doctors to make sure that they get down to a safe level. And it harkens back to that, you're putting the people who are putting their lives most at risk, and yet you're exposing them to something else. Now, you've got a firefighter who now has shown elevated PFAS levels, which I assume most of them would. Now what?
That's a good question. Once you have them in your body, they accumulate. They are stored in blood and fat tissue and proteins in general. So you cannot clean yourself up. They can do preventative screening to monitor their health and also avoid further exposure.
Okay.
But once we have them, there's nothing we can do about it.
Except for the monitoring, which sounds like, you know, that's a positive step.
It is a bit preventative. So as we were moving that piece of legislation through, we had our fire chief come up and testify, and his statements in committee were, it's probably too late for me, but this is about the next generation of firefighters.
It's very touching. Marta, so we've been hearing vaguely about PFAS, well, not only on items of clothing and on firefighter foam and others, But you brought up the point that it's leaches into the environment, or it's distributed into the environment in many ways. Can you talk about some of the environmental movements of a chemical like PFAS?
So, yes, when you think about the environment in general, PFAS are generally associated with water. They are water soluble, so they move through water. And so, as I mentioned before, for certain locations, contaminated water is the main route of exposure for people.
So when a chemical like PFAS is used and is sprayed on an area, for example, to stop a fire, which is probably a really good thing at the time, it doesn't just stay there, I assume. And so it travels through different environmental media. And what are those? How does it travel?
Yeah, so PFAS are mainly associated with water, either because there's contaminated water sources, because of what we were talking about the firefighter foams. They also, they travel also with water. We can find them in open lake waters, streams, rivers, also in the air. We have seen that they can be found in precipitation, in particles, so in rain, in particles that are in the air, and they cycle through the environment, and eventually they can end up in food. It's closing the cycle. But in general, when we think about PFAS, we think about water. That's the main compartment. In general, where they're found.
So how about me? You said I have PFAS in me, certainly. I just have that look, that PFAS glow. Is my likely exposure source water that I drink?
That's a tough question. We don't know. My first instinct would be depends on where you live. In Indiana, there's a couple of point sources, hot spots, so to speak. So if you were living there, I would say, yes, most likely that's the source. If you're not living there, then it's mostly the products that you use. You know, the rain jacket that I saw probably
my
has.
My rain jacket. No.
Has PFAS.
Okay.
So I think it's products that we use.
Oh, interesting. Thank you. That clarifies that a lot. So I've got to talk about manure.
Okay.
Why not? Right.
Do I get that question?
Yeah, I think we'll start with you. So people might or might not know that, you know, obviously we fertilize our crops with any number of things. Usually they're chemical fertilizers. A lot of crops are also augmented with manure. We already talked about confined feed operations in the previous episode. But it's areas where you're collecting manure, which has some valuable nitrogen and phosphorus and organic matter. So it's of some value to be back on a farm field. What are some of the risks of that?
Well, I'm a grape grower outside of being in the legislature, and with my passion for PFAS, I often wonder the history of the land that I farm. I do a lot of, I guess, old-fashioned farming where I'm in the dirt myself, mm-hmm. and I wonder if anyone ever used fertilizer that could be making me sick. And there's really no way for me to sample the soil, kind of like the firefighters, to sample their own blood to know if they've been exposed. Through my conversations with IDEM, there is a facility called Pace Labs that could do some soil sampling. Perhaps even IDEM could partner with Pace Labs, like Department of Homeland Security is partnering with Eurofins, and provide that for farmers who are interested. I feel like a large part of a responsibility of a legislator is providing these pathways for individuals to have information about their own health, about their property, about their place of employment, their career, and their exposure to their environment. That labeling legislation we talked about that passed unanimously was just informing the public about what is in their gear. And it's all about the right to know. Some of the legislation you saw last year that passed through that we successfully defeated with the work of Dr. Veneer and Dr. Peasley, moms came forward, other scientists, and reasonable members of the Senate decided we don't need this piece of legislation, 1399, which was a definition change of PFAS, which would have allowed manufacturers to continue using products with PFAS without informing the public, was a way to continue to mislead the public and tell them that some of these PFAS were safe. And I've never heard that there was a safe PFAS. But beyond that, what I feel is with this application of city sludge or sewage used as fertilizer, which 20 states in the U.S. allow, and Indiana is one of them, that we should at the very least inform that applicator, that farmer, that they are being exposed. They could potentially be exposed to PFAS. That it will forever be in that soil. It could go into your livestock or your crop. It could then be ingested by you if you're eating that crop. It could be into your drinking water. It could go into your community if you're selling that crop at your farmer's market, that you have the potential to be exposed and expose your community. And so at the very least, a notification. Stop this intentional misinformation, because in my conversations, they believe that farmers in Indiana should continue to have access to this cheap fertilizer. And I believe if we're going to provide cheap fertilizer, they should know the risks. Like a pack of cigarettes could cause cancer, may cause fertility issues. And that's exactly what PFAS exposure can do.
And Marta, what do you think is our general risks or concerns about PFAS in some of these, they call biosolids often. And so they are used as amendments, agricultural amendments. You know, there's no perfect solution to everything, but, you know, one could argue that, well, they reduce our dependency on chemical fertilizers, which are not all that great for the environment, and they also cost a lot of energy to produce. Any thoughts about that?
So I see the PFAS in biosolids issue almost as a whack-a-mole issue, where you remove PFAS from wastewater, which is great because we need the wastewater to be put back into our stream as clean water. But what do we do? Where are these PFAS gone? They went into the biosolids. And so now, oops, we're creating another problem. So PFAS have accumulated there because that's the whole process of accumulated chemicals that should not stay in the water.
So that part's good.
Exactly. So that part is good. The only problem is that then those biosolids are then applied to our soils, and potentially they can be uptaken by crops, not only farmers, but also crops. There's been some research that shows that crops, leaves, and some crops can uptake PFAS, so they can absorb from the soil. And so we end up, once again, being exposed to PFAS that way. I think as we talk about it, it starts to emerge how it's really a complicated issue dealing with these chemicals, because once you remove them from one media, then they appear in the other one.
The whack-a-mole issue, yeah. So tell me what you know, at least, about what health impacts PFAS have. Obviously, they must be a carcinogen of some kind if they cause cancers.
So, first of all, I'm a chemist and not a toxicologist. So I have to preface this, we know enough about the health effects about PFAS to be concerned, and that's the reason for some of the regulatory action that we have seen in the last few years, I want to say. And the research shows that exposure to PFAS has been associated with reproductive issues, decreased fertility, developmental issues. You mentioned lead, and so they have been associated with behavioral changes in children, much as lead does too. Increased risk of some cancers. Effects on the immune system. So there was a study in Greenland that showed that higher levels of PFAS were associated with a decreased response from vaccines. And so we have been all hearing about the importance of being vaccinated and vaccines, and so knowing that chemicals that are in our bodies decrease our response from vaccines is not something that we want to hear.
Now, wait a minute. There's PFAS in Greenland?
Yes, they travel everywhere because they are persistent. And so they've been found in the Arctic, in polar bears, in all corners of the globe.
I'm sorry, I cut you off on your discussion of health impacts.
That's fine. I think another issue they've been associated with is increased cholesterol levels. And we're all familiar with that. So we certainly don't want that as well. And also an increased risk of obesity. So when you think about all of these health effects together, I would say that we know enough to be concerned about having them in our bodies.
And preeclampsia and low birth weights were another risk factor too. And for me in the state of Indiana, that's a priority for us to focus on with our high infant and maternal mortality rates. So that was something I really pressed when we were focusing on the consequences of reducing any sort of regulatory guidelines around PFAS.
Okay. So let's get to the future a little bit. First of all, I'm going to let you have the last word, Maureen. I'm going to focus on you. What cool research are you doing right now that's going to help us understand where this stuff is or how it acts?
I want to say that PFAS will keep us busy for a very long time as chemists, because everywhere we have looked so far, we have found PFAS. Perhaps one of the biggest challenges that we have and that we are trying to address is which of these sources, and you can see sources as products,
okay,
are the largest contributors to our exposures. Because once we understand that, we can prioritize legislation, and we can prioritize which products we need to control first.
So maybe replace one offender with that. Yeah.
Exactly. So there are some safe replacements out there already that sometimes come at a cost, at a higher price tag. They also come with the increased benefit for our health. I want to say that that's the biggest question, to try to understand which of these sources are the most important ones so that we can control. And then we don't have to forget that there are certain uses that are necessary that we cannot live without. Those will be the last ones that we address, because we need to develop alternatives first. And so one of the challenges science and technology face is developing safe alternatives quickly, so that we can eventually replace all of the uses of PFAS in all products and applications.
As long as you don't come after my wrinkle-free cotton button-up shirts, because those are gold.
That's not PFAS, so you're safe.
Thank goodness.
Unless it's waterproof.
Yes, unless it's waterproof,
it's not.
Safe.
Not that I know.
Stain-proof.
Oh, good. All right, Maureen, I said the last word. You are now a PFAS champion for the state of Indiana. You can't see it here, but she's wearing a T-shirt that says all PFAS, all day, all year. Maureen, what do you see? What are you going to be pushing over the next couple terms, for example?
Well, common sense legislation to me just seems like notifying the public. So I think labeling, expanding that piece of legislation that passed unanimously last year for firefighters saying your gear has PFAS. I think we can push more manufacturers, more industry, more producers to say, who lined up last year saying we produce products with PFAS and we want to keep doing it, then put a label on your product and say, we produce products with PFAS, and you should know. Because a lot of them hid behind their lobbyists in committee and didn't testify publicly, but they were easily lining up to say, we want protection from government to do
okay.
so.
Okay.
So I think just a simple labeling to continue to let the public know their risk when choosing what shirt to wear, what dental floss to use. I also, want to follow other states and how they've looked to protect their farmers. There's a bill at the national level, a relief for farmers impacted by PFAS, that provides grants to farmers to address PFAS-contaminated agriculture and commercial land. That's kind of where my heart is with my background in farming. I, again, think that a lot of Indiana farmers don't know their impact. They may have health concerns, and they don't know where it's coming from. And then when you talked about the movie, it was farmers that led the way.
Yeah.
In the state of Maine, it was farmers who banned the use of PFAS fertilizers, sewage sludge. And I think that if farmers in Indiana knew they were being exposed to this, that they would also lead the way on this issue.
Oh, interesting. Well, thank you. That's a great way to conclude. And I want to thank you so much, Representative, for showing up and showing your heart and your hard work, and Professor, for your outstanding contributions to this field of PFAS chemistry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to thank Butler University for sponsoring the podcast and hosting us here. Our thanks also to the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust for making all of this possible. You can find us online at thecollectivetap.com. That's thecollectivetap, all one word, .com. And on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with that handle. Join us next time on The Collective Tap as we dive deeper into the world of water.